Welcome to the World Vision Report. 1 month after the big earthquake, Haitians consider resettling in Africa.
Just tell me when and where, and I'm going, because I have nothing left. Even if conditions are bad, could they be worse than this?
And for all our lovelorn listeners, a special potion from Senegal, just in time for Valentine's Day. And the sweet sounds of Sarah Tavarish.
You just let, you know, God work through you, and sometimes he gives you big hits, sometimes he gives big crowd favorites, sometimes just big ballads, sometimes just a quiet time.
Around the world with the World Vision Report, I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. Stay tuned. Welcome to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. In the aftermath of Haiti's earthquake, Senegal's president Abdoulaye Wade reached out to Haitians. He said Haitians who want to return to the land of their ancestors would be welcome in Senegal. So far, he's offered no details on that proposal, but that hasn't stopped the buzz on the streets in Haiti. Grant Fuller is in Port-au-Prince, and he filed this report.
Carlene Verneau stands in front of her new home. It's a makeshift tent set up on a concrete median between two roads. Her friend cooks a pot of food that several families will share. Once in a while, the smell of dead bodies wafts down from the collapsed third floor of a nursing school across the street. Verneau would rather be anywhere but here. And if she had a chance to go, Africa would be fine by her.
Just tell me when and where, and I'm going, because I have nothing left. Even if conditions are bad, could they be worse than this? I have no problem with it. As long as I can find a way to work, I'll be fine.
Overhearing this, her new neighbor Yannick Omage jumps in.
Well, she has no problem with it. But when you drop us there, are you just going to drop us in a place where we don't know what to do, or will you help us and then tell us to move on? You see what I mean? Will there be steps, or will it just be, okay, here's your land?
Rumors of an offer to move to Africa have been flying around Port-au-Prince ever since the president of Senegal raised the issue in the earthquake's aftermath. Some see the offer as a right of return. That's because most Haitians can trace their roots to West Africans who were forced into slavery in the Caribbean. Sitting on the curb outside the crushed National Palace, 24-year-old Esaïe says history tells him to stay right here.
I know Africa holds a special place in our story. But at the same time, my ancestors also fought for this land that we're on right now. And I can't imagine leaving it and going somewhere else, abandoning what they fought for.
Sitting right behind him, Isidore Girard seems more open to the idea. He's a college professor and accountant, and he's frustrated by the lack of aid from his government. But at the same time, he wants to make sure that whatever Africa has to offer will be an improvement.
I mean, could you practice your profession while you're there? Will you have the opportunity to live a decent life better than this? Or are we all just going to go to a camp like this again? What is it? What is the plan? Because we're here and there's no plan. We don't want to go somewhere else and be in the same situation. We want to know that when we go there, there's an actual future waiting for us.
So far, the Senegalese government has said nothing about what the arrangement would look like or when it would begin. At San Luis Gonzague Catholic School, now the site of one of the city's biggest camps, a lawyer mills around during a tent distribution. He doesn't want to give his name, but he says he recognizes the improbability of the whole deal.
I personally haven't heard anyone from our government telling us that yes, it is possible we can go. There's not a place to go and get the information. So right now, it's still a rumor to me and most people.
At the entrance to a United Nations base near the airport, three Nigerian troops stand guard next to a white tank. Over the past few weeks, many Haitians have come up to ask them about the Senegal option. All they can say is they don't know anything. One of the guards, Gabriel Nseya, doesn't see the point.
Even though they came from Africa, they cannot trace their house or their village in Africa. Africans can only give them an assistance. They can carry them back to Africa because this is their place now.
Radio stations in town have also said many people are coming to them with questions about Senegal. One of them finally put up a notice outside, giving the phone number for the Senegalese embassy in the U.S. But while they wait for more details on the plan to emerge, some Haitians wonder if there isn't a better solution. That includes 25-year-old Lucanair Muzak, who's standing on a sidewalk in the heart of downtown Port-au-Prince.
Wouldn't it be easier to come and help me rebuild my future in a place that I already know? What do I really know about Africa? Nothing. But I'm here. I know here. I live here. I work here. My family's here. I have property here. I have my future set here. We shouldn't focus on trying to build something new. Let's build this new Haiti right here in Haiti.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Grant Fuller in Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
You can find Grant's pictures from Haiti on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Haitians' love of music is legendary, and so is their religious faith. Grant Fuller was walking through Port-au-Prince a few days ago when he came across this service outside a damaged church. That's the sound of people singing outside the Apostolic Church of Jesus Christ in downtown Port-au-Prince. If any Haitians take up the offer to move to Senegal, they'll be heading to a country where libraries are few and far between. In Pekin, just outside the capital city of Dakar, one public library serves 1.5 million people. But it took a whole community to get it going. Now all it needs is books and a staff. Here's reporter Will Everett.
The heat and noise of Pekin can be unbearable, so finding a quiet place to read isn't just a luxury, it's almost a miracle. But 12-year-old Elha has found one inside the Pekin Cultural Center, a drab concrete building where the city's only public library is housed. Sitting cross-legged on the dusty floor, Elha says he likes to read storybooks in French, one of the two languages he speaks. He's finishing up a comic book he pulled down from the shelf this morning, and now he's ready for something else. So the librarian on duty helps him. Ngome Mbang is a thin, well-dressed woman in her late 20s. There's no card catalog here. The books are all listed on handwritten sheets in a loose-leaf binder, but she knows most of them by heart. She takes Elha to the section on literature and poetry, remarking that this section is popular and has a disproportionately large number of books. We walk past kids and young adults sitting at long tables or crouching on the floor with open books in their laps. A college student named Matthew looks up from a dusty volume of Victor Hugo.
I studied economics and management, but I read books which talk about my program. But at the holiday, when I have so much time, I will read another book with not talk about my program. Reading about Victor Hugo or Shakespeare just to complete my knowledge.
I continue to follow Ngome through the two high-ceilinged rooms, and I notice there's no electricity here. The next thing I notice is that some of the shelves are conspicuously bare.
There's no books.
Here we have the mathematics section, and there's nothing at all. We need a better equipped library, because as you can see, on this shelf, there's nothing.
Ngome has been working here for 5 years. She puts in a 40-hour week, though she doesn't receive a salary. That's right, she works without pay. She's taken courses in library science at the American Consulate, hoping it would improve her chances of getting a job here. But she says the city has been unresponsive.
It's a sacrifice, but these are the problems we face outside of the capital.
That's Moussafar, a volunteer who doesn't give his last name.
I have a stack of letters from the students thanking us for this library. Kids are learning and improving their lives because of the access to books we provide.
5 years ago, the city of Pekin promised to open a library here inside its newly constructed cultural center. It never happened. The mayor used the space for city offices, saying the city had no money to buy books. But that didn't stop a handful of volunteers who stepped forward to make the library a reality. Pape Ndiaye is the director of the Pekin Cultural Center.
The NGO Reading in Africa gave us 7,000 books. The American Cultural Center gave us some books in English and Arabic.
That's how our library came together, without any help from the local government.
Today they have around 11,000 books. For a city with a population the size of Philadelphia, that doesn't go very far. But there's hope that with the recent election of a new mayor, things are about to change. In Gome, the library volunteer isn't so sure. So we decide to pay the mayor a visit at his office. And Gome appeals to him to begin paying the library workers. At this, he seems confused. The mayor, Pape Sanye Mbaye, asks her how much she's paid, and is obviously surprised to learn that she works for nothing. At first, he doesn't show much interest, but he's soon moved by the force of her stern, quiet attitude.
Well, for 2010, with my no budget, I will be able to give them a salary and to put them in better conditions. Definitely, I will do it. You can trust me.
He says that if I contact Ngome in 6 months, I'll find that she's in a very different situation. Ngome says she won't hold her breath, but she's glad the mayor at least knows about the problem. Back at the library, she checks on Elha, the boy who was looking for something new to read. He shows her the book he found.
Mary Poppins.
It's Mary Poppins. He reads the opening paragraph, entering a world about as far from Pekin as he's liable to go, but a journey that wouldn't have been possible without the help of a handful of librarians who are still hoping that in time they'll see a paycheck for what they do and have the funds to fill their shelves. For the World Vision Report, this is Will Everett in Pekin Synagogue.
La bonne direction. Première à droite, deuxième à gauche.
We'll hear more from Will in Senegal later in the show. But now, we have love and marriage on our minds. It's Valentine's Week.
Money. I don't have enough to get married. I always ask myself, why is this happening? Is it because I've been working for 10 years and I did it all wrong? Is it because of society?
Stay with us for a story of thwarted love. We'll be back in a minute with the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. Valentine's Day is celebrated in Egypt, too. Shops are full of red roses, boxes of chocolates, and heart-shaped candies. In the Middle East, people are expected to get married in their early 20s or younger. But these days, that's tough for young men, and it's not because they can't find suitable partners. Daniel Estrin reports from Cairo.
At Casino Shubra, there's no money to be made. It's just the name of a coffee shop where old men gather to play dominoes and pass the time. Tayyib Muhammad sits alone in the back, sipping a cup of tea. He's 31, a lot younger than the other guys here, but his round belly and tired face make him look more like 40. He comes here after work, at a restaurant where he prepares kebabs.
I work 12 hours a day, so I can make 30 Egyptian pounds a day. Before I get home, I have to eat, buy a pack of cigarettes, so I spend 15 pounds. I come home with only 15 pounds.
That's less than $3 a day. And it's the main reason why Muhammad isn't married.
Money.
I don't have enough to get married. I always ask myself, why is this happening? Is it because I've been working for 10 years, and I did it all wrong? Is it because of society? Is it because everything is becoming expensive? And I don't know the answer.
According to Madihat Safti, the answer is complex. She's a professor of sociology at the American University in Cairo. Safti says the problem starts with tradition.
Marriage here in Egypt traditionally is very costly. You have to pay a lot to prepare yourself for the new life.
The man is expected to provide his fiancée with gold jewelry or diamonds. Then there's the money he has to give her to furnish the apartment that he has already acquired. Even the poorest Egyptians are expected to do all this. But Safti says for more and more people here, that's becoming impossible.
Yes, people are getting poorer and cost of living is getting to be higher. And at the same time, there's no change in the salaries.
To add insult to injury, Cairo's housing market has skyrocketed. Even an electrical engineer like 38-year-old Mohsen Salah, who makes good money, can't afford an apartment. He recently asked a girl's father for her hand in marriage.
The first question the family's father asked me was, do you have an apartment? Do you have a good salary? Have a good job?
Salah had to break off the engagement. Now he spends his evenings smoking a water pipe in street-side cafes. Delaying marriage is frustrating to Egyptians in many ways. Sexual relations outside marriage aren't accepted in Egypt. At the coffee house, Muhammad isn't embarrassed to talk about it.
I'm going to tell you honestly. I feel choked. I can't function well at work because I think about it.
2 years ago, Muhammad did finally propose to someone. She was willing to give him the money to cover the marriage costs. But Muhammad couldn't do it.
I couldn't accept that a woman would pay for the expenses. Her reaction was, don't be afraid. I can help you. We can get married. But it would be dishonorable for me.
For this reason and others, he decided to break up the engagement. To help get people married off, the government is building more low- and middle-income housing. Charities are subsidizing free mass weddings and donating household appliances to new couples. And more couples are arranging marriage contracts off the books, so to speak, with the help of Muslim clerics. These hush-hush marriages don't require as much money as a traditional engagement. Back in the coffee shop, Tayyib Muhammad says he's given up hope of ever being married. And that leaves him feeling incomplete and aimless.
I have no goal. I live just to eat, sleep, work. Eat, sleep, work. I have no one to go back to. I'm sorry to say it, but I live like an animal. 10 years ago, I had ambitions.
Muhammad begins to describe his dream life. He'd be married and save up enough money to open a restaurant for young guys. They'd come every day after work and hang out. He'd provide them with a kind of refuge, a place they could call home while they were still bachelors. He'd be their role model. But he's given up on that dream. The reality is that tonight, Tayyib Muhammad sits slumped in his chair in a cafe packed with old men and dominoes. And he's very lonely. For the World Vision Report, I'm Daniel Estrin in Cairo.
There might be some solutions to these problems of love and marriage far away in a little shack in Senegal, reporter Will Everett explains.
Muhammad didn't actually call it the love shack. But it was a shack, and what he sold there was love, of a sort. A little concrete room in back was festooned with herbs wrapped in small leather pouches.
This is my shrine, where I heal.
There were boxes of animal horns, lengths of hairy skins, and a collection of padlocks. These padlocks were part of Muhammad's unique stock in trade. He sold the kind of love that won't let you go. He was quick to point out that it's not a form of voodoo, but a natural remedy made from plants and animal skins.
It's from nature. This medicine we sell is from zoology and botany.
Muhammad wore a traditional Muslim robe and sported a black Rasputin beard. He claimed to have gone as far afield as India to learn the herbal remedies of unrequited love. He says he found that when the limbs of certain trees rub together, their bark generates a kind of magnetic attraction. When this bark is ground up and mixed with water and other herbs, he declined to say which, it gave off heat. He demonstrated by adding some water to a powdery substance in his hand.
You see this powder? It's what we make the tack.
Now, if you really wanted someone and didn't want to let them go, You poured a bit of this mixture into a large padlock. You whispered the person's name three times, then turned the key. It's called tak.
If you put that, this, you say, today, me, Mohammed, I want Fatou to meet me in my house. You open it, you go. Wherever she goes, she will come and meet you. It will affect her because she will be roaming about to look for me.
I learned about Mohammed through Gina, an American woman living in Senegal. She was an ardent believer in herbal medicine, though she'd never tried anything like tak before. But now Gina was having a problem with her boyfriend.
Sometimes he'll like disappear at night and say, oh, it was a family problem and stuff like that. You know, he's nice and everything. He seems like a good person, but it seems like, you know, there's something going on. Like, what could I do for that? He has these disappearances, you know?
Yeah.
What could I do about that?
If you want, tell me his name. I provoke his spirit directly to the padlock. Anything you want, you do.
How much would it cost for it?
If you do it today, immediately you see the work, it costs you 50,000 sefer.
$100. Seemed like a lot of money for a dime store padlock and some mud. Gina said she'd have to think about it. Mohammed invited us into his nearby apartment for tea. His wife was young and beautiful, and I asked Mohammed if he'd had to use tak to get her.
No.
He says that if she becomes a problem, he'll use tak. Somehow this sealed matters for Gina. What Mohammed was selling wasn't love, but possession. She said she'd be in touch. But by the time we were back on the street, she decided against tak. She was going to approach her problem the old-fashioned way. As soon as her boyfriend got home from work, she was going to sit down and talk to him.
Will Everett is a freelance reporter based in Texas. That's the voice of Sarah Tavares. She's a young Portuguese singer with roots in the Cape Verde Islands off the west coast of Africa. You can hear African and Portuguese rhythms in her songs, but there's also some gospel and American funk. It's a winning combination for Sarah Tavares. She's become a hit with world music lovers. Ishma Fundekwa is our world music guide, and he joins us now to talk about Sarah Tavares. Hi, Ish.
Hi, Peggy.
Tell us a little about this young artist. Her music is really beautiful.
Well, Sarah Tavares was born in Portugal, and her parents, having moved there from Cape Verde, the islands off the African coast, which was a former Portuguese colony. And once they got to Portugal, her parents took off again in search of a better life. Her father went off to the United States, and her mother headed to southern Portugal. And they left her with an elderly woman who raised her.
I'm wondering if she even considers herself African.
Yes, she certainly does. I have spoken to Sarah twice. First 2 years ago when she played at London's Queen Elizabeth Hall, and a few months ago when she played at a festival here in Harare, my hometown. And both times she has emphasized their African roots. And here's what she said the last time I spoke to her.
You know, every time I come to Africa, I don't come that often to Africa. So we feel all, you know, emotional. And especially sometimes we go to the Portuguese Africa, but we don't come this far out. So it's, you know, it's deep motherland. And for us, it is a big thing.
How did she even get her start as a musician?
From a very early age, she showed musical promise. And in her teens, she won numerous awards in Portugal. And in 1994, she was the Portuguese representative in the Eurovision Song Contest.
Is that kind of like our American Idol here, do you know?
The Eurovision Song Contest is a pan-European television contest where you have entrants from all the European countries, and people get to vote for the winner.
Sounds very young there, and as though her style has changed a lot since then. How old was she, Ish, when she sang in that contest?
She was only 16, and when I spoke to her, I asked her how she felt about her music and look then. Now, Sarah now sports dreadlocks and she had processed hair.
I think it's comic whenever I see it. But, you know, it's something that it's tender for me because it's my beginning. It's my really simple, small, but honest and authentic beginning. You know, you always have to begin by somewhere.
How did she do in that contest, Ish?
Now, she did not win, but it led to the release of her first album, Sarah Tavares and Shout, in 1996. It was a mix of gospel and funk with Portuguese influences. Her second album, Mima Bo, released in 1999, saw her incorporating more African influences. And the follow-up to that album, Balance, was released in 2006, and it was her breakthrough album.
Balance was her breakthrough album. Let's listen to something from Sarah on that album.
Okay, it's Planeta Sucri.
Ish, do you know what that song is about? What does Planeta Sucri mean?
Planeta Sucri means sugar planet, and she's talking about a place where there's no sadness, where everything is sweet and love is plentiful.
Is it a love song or a ballad, or maybe both?
And she says this place is inside of everyone, and she means it more in a spiritual way rather than a romantic way.
Do you know why the album and the title song are called Balance?
Well, Sarah told me that when she first came to Zimbabwe in 2001, she saw a couple of guys who were drunk, dancing, and they were almost falling over. And then they would catch themselves. She said they looked so graceful and balanced. And she also says it's about staying balanced between sadness and joy, day and night, salt and sugar. And it's about balancing emotions. Ish, you've listened to a lot of Sarah's music and you've interviewed her twice. How would you describe her music as a critic and what she's writing about? I asked Sarah herself how she describes her music, and she said she calls it Sarah's music. She says she writes about her experiences and what she sees around her, like when she was on tour in Mumbai, India, and was listening to all the sounds of the city. That resulted in a song called Mumbai, which is still to be released. Her music is easy on the ear, positive, and very uplifting.
And what's her latest album called?
Her latest album, called Shinti, was released a few months ago, and she says it's more laid back than the mostly upbeat Balance.
I think the major difference is that this is a more calm kind of album, I think, a more chill-out album, because I was touring for 3 years, so this was when I was coming back home and taking a deep breath and relaxing and coming into myself again. It's more intimate, I think, this album.
Well, let's listen to a piece from this album to see what she's talking about.
Yeah, there's this ballad called Ponto de Luz, which means point of light. I'm not too sure if it's a romantic love song or maybe a song about God.
Sounds very much like a ballad to me. Let's choose a song to go out on, Ish. What would you pick?
Let's listen to Bue, another track from Shinti, and here's what Sarah says about it.
I feel that Bue, it's a very communicative song. You know that one that I feel good, very nice. It's a reggae, and it's a very happy song. There's another one called Sumanai. It's kind of African and reggae again. It's more upbeat. I don't know. But, you know, these things happen. You cannot make them happen. You just let, you know, God work through you. And sometimes he gives you big hits. Sometimes he gives big crowd favorites. Sometimes just big ballads. Sometimes just a quiet time.
Ish, thank you for speaking to us about Sara Tavares. She might be one of my favorites in a long time. I'm going to have to go out and get that album.
You need to check Sara Tavares out, Peggy. She's really, really, really good. I think she's one of the brightest stars of African music at the moment.
In rural India, the radio's playing in the kitchen.
My favorite are the health programs. If I have a cough or a fever, I know what sort of leaf I need to find and what to do with it. I learned that from the radio.
And we'll tune in after a short break. This is the World Vision Report. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. In villages scattered through south-central India, women who were once called untouchables are finding their lives are getting better. And it's all because of radio. But not just any radio. Peter Aronson explains.
In a shady courtyard surrounded by lush green fields of millet, an old woman is telling me about the past. 80-year-old Bayava explains what it meant to be a Dalit here in rural Andhra Pradesh in the bad old days.
We were untouchable at that time. Our houses were outside the village. So if we walked into the village, we had to remove our shoes and hide them in our clothing and walk barefoot into the village. If high caste people came, I had to cover my head.
She never went to school, Bayava tells me, and neither did any of her children. And yet this unschooled former farmhand can now talk knowledgeably about all kinds of issues, like microfinance and empowerment groups, thanks in part to a local radio station run by Dalit women.
I don't have a radio of my own, but my neighbors have one, and they bring it, and I listen every evening.
In a culture where few people can read or write, this radio station, called Sangam Radio, which means simply community radio, plays the role of news outlet, library, cultural center, and school. The two-hour broadcast comes on every evening, right around the time most Dalit women in the area are making dinner for their families. Nagamma is one of them. Her cement house is filled with the pungent, smoky aroma of fried onions and chilies. She's making dinner while listening to Sangam Radio.
I learn things on the radio. On TV and other radio, there are people speaking that I don't know. But here, we know the people who are speaking. That makes me feel encouraged to go and speak myself sometimes. In fact, I've done that.
That's because the people in the audience aren't just passive listeners. They're invited to get involved and share their knowledge. In the very same place where at one time Dalits like Nagama couldn't even show their faces on the street, Dalit women and men now proudly broadcast their voices into hundreds of homes every day. Two Dalit women run the show in the studios of Sangam Radio. General Narasimha and Algul Narasimha, no relation, are much like the majority of Dalits who live here, except they can read and write, and that's rare. They received special training from both a local organization and from UNESCO to run the station. Sangam Radio was started and is still overseen by the local group, Tech and Development Society. The women work for the society, and funding to build the station came primarily from UNESCO. One of the women, General Narasimha, says at first they were nervous.
At the moment each broadcast would start, we felt like we were approaching a tiger face to face.
But General and Algul say they've mastered the process and conquered their fears. General opens a cabinet with a sliding glass door. It's full of cassettes holding a wealth of local knowledge that they and other employees have collected over the past 11 years. There are educational recordings about health, recordings of local Dalit villagers playing music or recounting local history. This is all about agriculture, how you can improve your land, how to grow mixed crops. This is about watersheds, including our Dalit watershed. And those are tapes of some elders talking about their lives, talking about how things have changed for them. Sangam Radio is keeping all that unwritten local knowledge alive by sharing it with people every day. Another listener, a mother of three named Anitamma, says the daily radio program brings her joy, even if her husband is shouting at her. But she says Sangam Radio has also helped her in concrete ways.
My favorite are the health programs. Earlier, if I got sick, I would just lie down at home, not knowing what to do, and without any hope that I'd get better.
Now, because she listens to the program,
if I have a cough or a fever, I know what sort of leaf I need to find and what to do with it. I learned that from the radio.
The station also hires local women to work as part-time reporters. It pays them a small amount to conduct interviews and record stories or songs with digital recorders. It's a way to encourage even more people to participate on the air. For the World Vision Report, I'm Peter Aronson in Andhra Pradesh, India.
And now we head to another part of India, where dosas are cooking in neighborhood kitchens. Dosas are a thin crepe stuffed with filling, like potatoes. They're as popular in India as pancakes are here in the U.S. But there's one difference. Indians eat dosas all day long. Our reporter Mary Stuckey found out just how much work goes into making the perfect dosa, and she sent us this report for our What's Cooking series.
Rashmi Sharma and her husband, Kabir, are doctors. They live in an apartment above their clinic, just north of Delhi, and they come upstairs to have lunch together nearly every day. On this day, Rashmi is cooking dosa, thin Indian pancakes with a savory filling. She began the process several days ago. It all starts with black lentils that are shelled, revealing the white kernel beneath the skin.
And we have to soak this white lentil, one part of this and three parts of rice. There are fenugreek seeds also, which we put 1 teaspoon in it. I want to show you that also. This is the 1 teaspoon.
Fenugreek tastes a bit like burnt sugar.
This has got special flavor, which you will enjoy when you eat the dosa.
Rashmi covers the mixture with water and leaves it to sit overnight. And in the morning,
so you're grinding the soaked rice and lentil together with a little bit of water.
Yes, a little bit of water. To make it a pouring consistency like this.
Rashmi sets this batter aside in a warm, dark spot for at least a day, sometimes two. After it's fermented, she stirs the batter, and then readies a hot skillet with a little oil or ghee, which is clarified butter.
so that I can spread the dosa better on it.
On a flat skillet?
Flat skillet, yes, very thin one, yeah.
This looks tricky to me.
It's tricky. Even for people in India, it's tricky.
That's because the dosa is so thin it can break apart when it's lifted from the pan.
Tell me what you have waiting in the skillet next to it.
This is onion and potatoes with some green chilies and coriander green. That's it. We boil the potatoes, then peel it off, then cut it, and then fry first onion, and then put the spices and salt, and then potatoes.
It's ready?
Yeah, it's almost coming up.
That's magic. This dosa kind of pops up from the pan.
Yes, exactly. If the technique is good, and if the technique is not proper, then it is going to be messy.
This is very impressive.
Rashmi spreads the potato filling on the dosa and rolls it up.
Now you taste it and tell me, how is it?
Okay, let's go.
Yeah, come, sit.
Okay.
Rashmi's husband, Kabir, joins us for lunch.
So we can think about millions of Indians right now with us eating their lunch of dosa.
Absolutely. Dosa is very popular as a meal, as a snack, as everything.
Mmm. Oh, isn't this great? These are good. Mmm. Very crispy.
And so in India, even in busy families like the Sharmas, cooking is not something that can be rushed.
So it is time-consuming. Not that we open a tin and just mix this, mix that, and serve it. No. This is the type of love and affection we have for each other.
With that, she heads back into the kitchen to make another batch of fresh, crispy dosas.
I think I'm catching on to something. Is it true that the dosa cook can never sit down?
Yes, exactly. I can't sit down with you. It gets soggy.
Soggy.
Yes.
So the dosa cook is stuck in the kitchen cooking.
Yes, exactly. Like me. And you can very well see.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Mary Stuckey eating dosas with Rashmi and Kabir Sharma in Ambalikant, India.
Take a look at the photos of Mary's dosa cooking session on our website, worldvisionreport.org. If Mary and Rashmi Sharma had turned the radio on while they were cooking, they might have heard this. The hit song is called Sajda. It's from the Bollywood film called My Name is Khan, and it's sung by Rahat Ali Khan and Richa Sharma. Bollywood film My Name is Khan had a glittering premiere in Abu Dhabi last week. It opens in the U.S. this weekend. Jessica Markovitz considers herself a normal American teenager. She likes movies, fashion, and her friends. But Jessica has another passion, sending girls to school in Rwanda. Rwanda is a world away from Jessica's home in Seattle. So how did this all start?
In 2006, this man named Richard Kanaga came to Seattle on behalf of the Unity and Reconciliation Commission, and he came to speak about the rebuilding of hope and reconciliation in his country, Rwanda. And he was hosted by my family and I when I was in sixth grade, and he shared some stories with me about how Rwanda went through the genocide in that war in 1994, and that was the first time I had heard about it. And so I felt sort of an urge to do something for those kids, especially girls.
Is there anything in particular that Richard told you that made you decide you really wanted to do something about it?
I think it was really about how many children lost their parents and are now the head of the households, so they can't put education as their first priority because they can't afford it. So that's what I wanted to try and do and involve other people to help me out with that.
So what is it that you decided you would do after hearing Richard's stories about children in Rwanda?
Well, I knew that other kids would be interested because there aren't many opportunities for kids to make a difference. And so at the time I was going to an all-girls school and I asked if any other girls would be interested and it turned out about 10 of them were. And so from there we started brainstorming what we could do as a group of 11 girls. And we decided we wanted to raise money for girls to go to school. And we wanted to do this because we wanted to give every girl the same opportunity to go to school and have a future and be successful.
So how did you and the other 11 girls raise money?
It started out with a couple of bake sales and making a couple hundred of dollars, and $40 supports a girl to go to school for a year. So we actually were making a big difference with just the money we made from a bake sale. Since then, we have about $70,000.
From bake sales?
No.
What else have you done? That's an awful lot of baking.
Well, we still do a lot of baking, but we have applied for a couple of grants, and another $10,000 was from my bat mitzvah, where I donated my money. And I just recently won an award called the World of Children Award, and that was for $15,000.
Do you know how many girls your fundraising has actually helped get to school?
Yeah. Well, when I was in sixth grade, Richard connected me to 22 girls. And so for the past 3 years, we've been funding for those 22 girls to go to school. We're going to expand, hopefully this year, to add 28 more girls, which will make, or 27, to make 50 girls total.
And I understand, Jessica, you've even gotten to travel to Rwanda to see the work and meet some of the girls. Can you tell us a little about that?
Sure. In the summer of sixth grade, so when I first started that summer, my mom and I thought it would be a good idea to go and visit these girls. And so each girl was really shy and sort of had their head down, but they still wanted to talk. And each one of them had a very sad story of losing their father or their mother or even both of their parents. And so that year was incredible just to see their faces and see what we can do for these girls. And they were just really happy. And I've been back twice.
Did you get to know any of the girls or have you kept up with any of them?
Yeah, there's one girl whose name is Grace. And the first year I met her, I could sort of see she had this little spark in her and was a very intelligent girl. And each year as I came back, she was stronger and stronger. And this year when I came back, she was this completely new person who had her head up. Her English was perfect. She helped the other girls speak English to me when they needed to. And she was this strong and powerful woman. And so that was through supporting her and meeting her that she became this girl.
Are there any girls in particular whose stories have really stayed with you and who you'd want to tell us a little bit about?
Yes. This past summer, I visited a couple of the girls' homes, and one of these girls named Esther lives with her two other sisters and her father, who's paralyzed. And one of the sisters is sick, and the father can't move. And so right after school, she has to come and help out with the chores, and they sleep in one room. And this just really shows how hard it is for these girls, and we just want to be there for them and give them the love and support that they need.
How old are you?
I'm 14, so I've been doing it for 3 years.
Mm-hmm. You're 14. You sound like you're 14 going on 18. Very articulate and a lot of vision for a young woman.
Thank you.
So what's it been like for you?
It's been fun sometimes to think about how this all started and how big it's turning into and how it's really turning into a big movement that I hope will continue forever. And it's just nice to know that one little step can take you into making a huge difference.
Thank you so much, Jessica, for joining us today.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Jessica Markowitz is the founder of Richards Rwanda, an organization that helps finance the education and mentoring of girls in Rwanda. She joined us from Seattle. And we leave you there today. Remember, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, worldvisionreport.org. And while you're there, you can read blogs from our reporters around the world. The program was produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is our engineering assistant. Chris Baldiga is our production assistant. And I'm Peggy Waymire. Are you well, Rwanda? Are you well, Gola? Are you well, Bahia?
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.
Mulemba Shangola, ayuwe Mulemba Shangola,
Salvador da tradição, Mulemba Shangola, unidas nações, soltai-vos agora.
Mulemba Shangola, ayuwe Mulemba Shangola.